Thank you for listening to Indigenous Land Relationships, Writing Our Relations. This audio documentary features Roo, citizen of the Catawba Nation. Indigenous people have inhabited the lands on which Duke University sits for millennia and continue to thrive here today. Duke University sits on the ancestral territories of the Eno, Okanichi, Saponi, Shikori, Ashashir, and Tutelo peoples. Despite genocide committed by European powers and the United States, over 1,100 of these people unite today as the Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation, headquartered in Alamance County, North Carolina. In addition to the Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation, I recognize and honor the seven other indigenous nations that currently reside in North Carolina: the Coharie, Lumbee, Maharan, Halliwa Saponi, Waccamaw Siouan, Saponi, and the Eastern Band of Cherokee. I recognize Duke University's participation with settler colonialism, including Trinity College profiting from the Cherokee Indian Industrial School, and Duke Tobacco dispossessing indigenous lands and profiting from their imagery. We will uphold Duke to its recent commitment to anti-racism and will continuously look for new ways to make reparations. And now for Indigenous Land Relationships, Writing Our Relations.
Tanake, Niat Delesan George Warren, Niat Nitem Ru, Yang Iswanre, Yang Katabare, Yang Kampi, Sawachahare, Yaksuna, Wanda George Warren, Tatewana, Buck George, Hakchuna, Yakchune, Dr. Winona Hare, Hawo Manu, Hawo Numti, Hawo Huksu, Hawo Iswan. Hi, my name is Deleslin George Warren, but everyone calls me Ru. I'm a citizen of Catawba Indian Nation. We call ourselves the people of the river because in our stories, we've lived along the river since the world began. Our knowledge of who we are as people comes from the Catawba River and the surrounding landscape. I am a citizen of Catawba Nation as well as a consultant for the tribe, working on lots of different things, including language and food system work. And in Catawba, I describe myself as Yang Kamping Sawacha, which is a word that can mean both artist and teacher. Because if you are, for example, a potter, which is our oldest unbroken tradition, you're also de facto a pottery teacher. So a lot of my work is about how to make education artistic and art educational. And then I also gave thanks to the land and to the river, to the sun and to the rain. So in my introduction, there's kind of several pieces to it. One is the greeting. The next is the description of who I am. I'm a citizen of Catawba Nation. I am the son of Wanda and the grandson of Buck George and the nephew of Winona. I tell you about how I see my work in my community. But then I end with gratitude to the earth and to the river and to the things that sustain us. And in our language reclamation work, part of that is reclaiming, rethinking, revitalizing the way in which we introduce ourselves to each other and to the world. Because we simply wouldn't exist without the earth, without the river, and without the sun, and without the rain, right? Because it helps us center ourselves, right? I'm not an individual talking, right? I'm someone who is also in relationship with the land and to the eagle and to the sun and all these other things, just as you are the person I'm speaking with. When I think of the popular conception of Indigenous people and their relationship to the land, I picture one of these t-shirts that you can find in like a Walmart or a Target of like this Native person at a cliff with a giant moon in the background with a wolf over it. You can just tell there's magic in the air, right? And so there's this sort of magical, spiritual, ineffable characteristic that is often applied to Indigenous people's relationships with their land. Like Pocahontas, for example, literally speaking to the tree. And what I find impoverished about that understanding is that our relationship with the land is not born of some innate spirituality or magical woo-woo anything. It's born of living on these lands for 6,000 years. You learn something about the land in that time. And so when I talk about Indigenous Catawba, specifically land knowledge, it's not that one day a bird flew in and whispered it into my ear. It's that these are lessons that we've learned over time. And I think that what's important about that, we also sometimes think of Indigenous people as being pure and innocent, but we're not. We are people. And so when we talk about extraction or unsustainable farming practices, I know that there are examples in Indian country of tribes who have stories of their ancestors or other peoples who were living in such a way and it led to destruction. And so that's part of living on the land for 6,000 years, is that even when we tried things, we've been here long enough to see how they turn out. Whereas industrialized agriculture, the United States specific system of land occupation has only been here for 250 years, if you're talking since the Revolutionary War, about 400 years, if you're talking since the founding of Jamestown. That is a very short timeline, an incredibly short timeline, particularly when talking about landscape level management. So we have a very atomic language. And so we got the prefixes, we got the postfixes, we got the interfixes, we got the circumfixes. Every utterance is in a mood or a tense. And so it would be like in English if we were able to put like a sentence within a sentence within a sentence within a sentence. So in Catawba, first off, there's no word for these English categories of animal, plant, which is very crucial in English, right? We distinguish in our language between humans and animals, even though humans are in literally every way just animals. So we don't have those sorts of categorical distinctions. And so, for example, we have a word for tree, right? Because that's kind of a category that makes sense. We have a word for small kind of herbaceous plants, serac, which is, you know, another category that makes sense. We have a word for bird because the things that fly is, you know, a category that makes sense. A word for snakes, a word for turtles, a word for fish. But we don't do this kind of top level philosophical categorizing, which is really important in the English language, maintaining that hierarchy of humans at the top with animals and plants and quote unquote inanimate things like rivers and mountains below them. Another interesting fact, and these are things that we just assume all languages would have if we were raised in English, but there's no word for nature. What is nature? Nature is us. Nature is everything, right? It's not over there and we're over here. And even within the words themselves, the way they're constructed, they carry knowledge about the animals. So like the word for goose, ahon, ahon. And so in some ways it's nice because we let the goose name themselves, but it's also like you're walking around and even if you've never met a goose, never heard a goose sound before, but you knew this word for ahon, and then you hear that sound, you're like, oh, okay, that must be ahon, right? One of the things I do is cultural integration into our childcare programs. And so right now I'm working with the 0-1 classroom and they just sing a lot in there, like, good morning, good morning. And so we were like, okay, great. Let's just write some Catawba songs for this. And so I just wrote one last week called a bird song. It translates to, hello, bird. How are you? Hello, bird. How are you? And then this part where they say the bird names. My favorite part is when we say the robin's name, because it's another one that's named after how it sounds. Weespuckpuck. And so the song goes like, Tanake kuchin yin ya tanane. Tanake kuchin yin ya tanane. Weespuckpuck, 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 tanake. And it's just so fun. So it's not even just that the knowledge is like a spreadsheet that targets specific animals or specific pieces of knowledge, but the language itself expresses that knowledge in the way that it's built. I think sometimes people are looking for the individual that's doing things. And the reality is in tribal communities, it's always building upon things that came before. It's always with the intention of setting the stage for what comes after. And it's always working with lots and lots of people and lots of different programs. So a few years ago, when I returned to the reservation to work on language, one of the things that I realized very quickly was that a lot of the language was not going to make sense to me unless I knew about the land and learned about the plants and the animals that are on the land. And so I started working with our cultural center's gardens. And by started working with, I mean that my boss basically said, you're in charge of these 40 garden boxes. And so I did a crash course in like permaculture and ecological design and those sorts of things, and have made many, many mistakes over the years. But what has really shifted in my thinking is at the beginning, I was very dedicated to this idea of native plants. But peaches are not traditional. When Spaniards came through, Catawbas and lots of other Southeastern people tasted the peach and said, wow, this is delicious, and it grows here. We're going to start growing it. So within 200 years, when explorers are coming through the Piedmont areas of North and South Carolina, they start finding giant groves of peaches. And so when we started talking again about what plants are we prioritizing, we reassessed and realized that, yes, our indigenous plants have a special place and could never be replaced. They may not exist anywhere else in the world. So, for example, the Schweinitz sunflower, we know that it is incredibly rare. It's on the endangered species list. Us and other people in the Piedmont, we have a special responsibility to that sunflower. But we also realize that the real traditional posture towards new plants for Catawbas was not, oh no, we're not going to bring that in, but rather, how do we bring it in a good way and make sure that it's not destroying what's already here? And you see that with so many different traditional varieties. For example, Catawba corn, that was not made on Catawba land. That was not domesticated on Catawba land. There had to be a point at some time in the past when someone brought corn, or Catawbas brought corn back from a trading, and they said, this is great, let's keep growing it. And it's through the act of growing it, building that relationship over generations and generations of both Catawbas and the corn, does it become a part of us and a part of our community, right? It's not the same corn that was brought to our community thousands and thousands of years ago. It's corn that reflects the values of our ancestors and what they selected for year after year. For example, I always thought this was an interesting question. Like, water is so crucial to modern corn production, but I just could not figure out in what world our ancestors would be hauling water to water the corn. Like, it just seems deeply impractical to me. And so what we did was we grew some of this corn when we found these seeds. So the story of the Catawba corn, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it stopped being grown, particularly as Catawbas continued to enter the workforce and have less time to manage their own gardens and farm plots. So the corn stopped being grown. And when I started working on food sovereignty, everyone said, we got to find the corn. And so we were very, very lucky, thanks to David Shields and the North Carolina Extension Office. They were able to find a descendant of Catawba corn, which had been kept by this family in Hickory, North Carolina. So when we brought it back into the community that first year, we wanted to make sure, you know, we were watering some of it, making sure we grew it in just the perfect conditions so we would get enough seed for next year. But then we also did a plot or two where we didn't water it at all during the year. We just let the rain take care of it. And those also produced. And so now we're actively encouraging people not to water the corn so that we can continue to strengthen and select for those genes that are drought resistant and don't require the intervention of irrigation. So that's just one kind of project that we're working on with the Catawba corn and how it's really shifted our thinking. What I'm very passionate about is trying out new plants, right? Because every tradition has its first day on the job. We are in a moment of climate chaos. We do not know what's happening in the future. And so what we need to be doing is exploring lots of different varieties, figuring out what's going to be resilient, what's going to carry us through this time, and then start doing the work that's going to allow the next generation to receive these as traditional seeds. And it's so wonderful to work with seeds from other tribal communities, from around the world, and figure out if they're appropriate for us and if they are something we want to invite into this community for the long term. Who owns seeds? Seems like it might not be a big question, but it is one of the most profound economic questions in the world right now. A lot of local farmers and indigenous communities are really, really concerned with GMOs, not because of safety. What you hear people actually concerned about is who owns the genetics and who owns the seeds. Do farmers have a right to save seeds and grow them again the next year? Indigenous people, I think, and farmers around the world would argue that that is a human right. And it's also a right of the plant, right? This is an agreement that we make with these crops, which is you grow, you provide for us, and we will continue to plant you year after year. We'll ensure that the next generation happens for you. And right now, with the way that patents are happening with seeds, that's not becoming possible for a lot of people, and it's causing a lot of havoc. So indigenous people around the United States and around the world are working on reclamation efforts, which are saying, like, so many seeds have been taken from our communities, sometimes to be adapted into some sort of variety that is then sold and patented or trademarked. And they're saying, we're going to bring those back to our communities. And what you also see is communities having really different ideas on what sharing those seeds mean. I think what we're learning from Catawba Nation is, like, with our corn seeds right now, we're only sharing it with our citizens and our tribal households. But that's a more practical thing of just, we don't have a lot of seed right now. But there doesn't seem to be a huge reticence to sharing seeds outside the community, because we recognize that the reason we were able to get these seeds back is because at some point our ancestors shared them with the family in Hickory, North Carolina, that preserved the seeds for so long. And that's a lesson that the seeds themselves give, right? Like, you open up a squash, the squash isn't doing two seeds. It's doing hundreds, if not thousands of seeds, right? If we were a plant, if we're a plant and we're in the board meeting, we're deciding how many seeds to produce. If we're taking a profit model, those extra seeds might be described as profit loss or excess, right? But really that excess is resiliency. And it's that interweaving that's going to provide resilience for us, particularly as we navigate this changing climate. I think there's a couple of things to learn from traditional Catawba and other indigenous land management practices. The first off is the attention to landscape level management. That is something that is not thought about enough, particularly from federal and state agencies, in terms of how lands are managed, because of the way that land is bought, sold, and treated as property in the United States. It's pieces of preserved land separated by areas of intense development. And that is not sufficient to protect these ecosystems. One thing for us to consider is how we might bring fire back into land management practices. So here's a story. A long, long time ago, most of the world was dry except for this one place along the Catawba River. And there was First Woman and Sky Man and all of their children, as well as all the animals that they shared the land with. There was one animal, Double Wong, who was known for causing a little trouble. And one day he was sitting on a hill, and he sees on this bigger hill far away this light, like a small sun. And he's like, well, what is that? I will investigate. So he hops all the way over to this bigger hill. And when he gets there, he sees this fire. And around this fire is a circle of buzzards, which, if you've seen a group of buzzards circling something, it's quite terrifying. But Double Wonk is brave and sometimes foolish. And so he goes up to the buzzards and he says, oh, buzzards, what is that? What is that that you have? And they say, oh, this is Ingpi. This is fire. This is what keeps us warm when it's cold. And Double Wonk says, oh, please, 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 can I be near this fire? Can I please touch this fire, please? And they said, no, Double Wonk, go away. You're annoying us. So he goes around to the other side of the circle and says, oh, please, 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 let me sit next to the fire. And they say, no, Double Wonk, go away. And so he goes away and he's standing far away and he's tapping his foot. And he's like, how am I going to get that fire? And as he's tapping his foot, he looks down and sees some twigs next to his foot. And he says, aha, I have an idea. So he takes those little twigs and he sticks them between his toes. And he hops back up to the buzzards and says, oh, buzzards, please, won't you just let me warm my foot? I promise I'll leave you alone once you let me warm my foot. And they say, okay, fine, Double Wonk. If it'll make you leave us alone, that's fine. And so he takes his foot and he reaches as close to the fire as he can get. And he says, ah, the fire is so nice. And then he says, ah, the fire is very hot. And then he says, ah, my foot is on fire. And so he starts hopping and hopping away, trying to get his foot to stop being on fire. He hops through the woods. He hops through the fields. And then he finally gets down to the river and he hops in the river and he says, ah, thank God. He turns around, and what does he see? That all of the woods and all of the fields are on fire. All of the animals are running from the fire. They're having to take shelter in the river and the creeks. And he sits there crying, oh, no, no, what have I done? What have I done? And First Woman says, oh, Double Wonk, don't cry. Look at what you've done. And so the next morning, as the sun rises, they see new grass coming up in the fields and in the forest. Deer goes up to this new grass and says, this is the best grass I've had in my entire life. Now, that's a story I'd heard when I was younger. I had no idea what it was about until I started working in food sovereignty and began through the help of our elders and through Dr. Brooke Bauer and many others learning about this ecotype of a Piedmont prairie and how crucial fire was to that management practice. And after hearing about this Piedmont prairie and hearing from other tribes about their traditional fire practices, I said, oh my gosh, this is not just a weird story about the rabbit. It's an instructional story about how to manage the land. And so when you're looking out at this prairie, one thing to think about is, one, like, what are the ecological services that they're providing? A lot of the plants that are endangered or on watch lists, like Schweinert sunflower, the Georgia aster, are incredibly resilient plants. They will grow anywhere. The one thing that they can't deal with is woody overgrowth blocking out the sunlight. And so what do you have less of in these burn savannas? That woody overgrowth. This is something that is of particular concern to tribes out west, particularly in California, where they have very strong traditions of managing the land through burning all the way up until the, you know, at least the 1800s and into the 1900s when it was banned, literally banned for them to manage their land in this way, because it was viewed as destructive by conservationists. Little did conservationists realize, but it was actually those practices that created the abundant landscapes that settlers were seeing and describing as things like gardens of Eden and a cathedral of God. It is because of indigenous people that those landscapes looked the way that they did. And that is the other piece about how we think of ourselves in relationship to the rest of the world. When we talk about conservation, when we talk about sustainability, I rarely talk in those terms because I think that those are aiming way too low in terms of goals. I'm looking at revitalization. I am looking at integrated management. Like, that's where I want to go with it. And the reason that conservation and sustainability, I feel like, are insufficient is because it, again, paints this picture that the only relationship between humans and the rest of the world, the only thing it can be is either destructive or minimally destructive by us taking conservation efforts. And that is not true. The story we have to tell is that humans can be part of and essential to a landscape that is more vibrant, more abundant, more biodiverse than anything that could happen without us there. We are very good at certain things. For example, edges. We make great edges. We're very good at making edges between forests and fields and marshes and beaches. And those are the spaces ecologically where you see the most biodiversity happening. So just in that one practical way, humans, you know, aren't just either damaging or preventing damage, but are a part of how the landscape becomes vibrant, becomes full, becomes rich and sustaining. It's amazing when you realize that that's just a story we've been telling ourselves, that humans can only be destructive or limiting in our destruction. Why is that a story we're telling when it's not based on fact? And what's possible when we start telling the story that We are incredibly capable primates. Like, we can do amazing things. So how do we move forward from this moment, right? We're all living on the land. And I think sometimes there's a fear that tribes are advocating. When we say land back, we're not saying land back and we're kicking everyone off, right? Because we recognize that that would be genocide. That is not what we're advocating for. Again, what tribes are actually advocating for is that they are not just consulted, but have rights of refusal and rights of agreeance for lands that they have been managing for millennia. And so one thing that folks from outside of indigenous communities can do is, when talking about land and when thinking about environmental policies and agricultural policies, always considering whether or not indigenous people have been involved in this decision and deciding that that's something important. I think another way, and this is more personal, but you have to connect to the land that you're living on. You have to get to know it. You have to know the time of year that it gets so rainy that you can't walk around because it's muddy. You have to figure out that one week in the summer where it'll go from completely dry and hot to giant thunderstorms. You need to know where the sun is going to hit and which tree is going to bloom first, because that is what is missing right now. We have lost our relationships to the land we have lost the ability to talk about our relationships with the land, because the reality is that we are all already in relationship with the land. Unfortunately, because of the way our communities are structured, it is generally a very bad relationship with the land. So when thinking about personally what you can do, I think it's about writing that relationship with the land and remembering that the land gives to us, but we also need to give back to the land. And so in thinking about the ways in which we might begin to write our relationships with the land, recognizing that because Indigenous communities have been in relationship with the land for so long, it's going to necessitate you being in right relationship with Indigenous communities. We've got to be in relationship with the land, in good relationship with the land, and with each other.
This documentary was created by me, Quinn Smith, citizen of the Chickasaw Nation, with music by Jesse Gallagher. Once again, thank you for listening.